Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station, broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Sunday evening, July 5th, 2009. It is now about 7:01 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Or email us anytime at comments@libertytalkradio.com. I encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, mytwocentsonline.com. mytwocentsonline.com, and that two is a numeric two. In his weekly newsletter, Andy discusses economic issues and how they affect you. You can also listen to Andy's commentary on contraryinvestorscafe.com. Lastly, I would like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. Well, good evening, everyone. This evening is a big event. Of course, this evening we have with us, we are so pleased to have with us, I should say, as our guest, Mr. Dr. William Lenhart II, PhD. He's the founder of the 2B Foundation. This organization attempts to solve the problems by those facing the latter years of life without government intervention, which, folks, believe it or not, includes everyone here. Everyone is listening, regardless of your age, because we're all going to face that someday. A task to be admired for sure. Mr. Lenhart will discuss the issues facing our aging population together with solutions that he sees viable on an international scale. Now, I'd like you to join us. I listen carefully and call in with your questions or comments, 646-652-4620. And, of course, our email address, comments@libertytalkradio.com. I have a little introduction that was sent to me by a colleague of his that actually had passed away shortly after he wrote this. He said, this is by Dr. John Cull, doctoral committee chairman and longtime professional advocate, colleague and close friend of Bill Leonard, made the following observations about his personality, drive, and character. And I'm reading this because it's so fascinating. He says, Bill is somewhat of an atavistic, 19th century romantic, classical pianist, and professional with concomitant manners and interest, critically thinking with visceral passion for the seasons, spontaneous excitement, adventure and challenges. Like many other intensely creative men, he was overendowed with one of human male's most characteristic qualities, the joy of risk-taking. Every creative act, every new formula, every groundbreaking innovation is an act of rebellion that may, if successful, destroy an old existing concept. So every time a brilliant mind sees a new possibility, it is faced with a moment of supreme risk-taking. The new formula, the new invention may not work. It may turn out to be a disaster. But the man of genius, such as Lenhart, has the courage to plow ahead, despite the dangers both on and off the intellectual field. He has a PhD in research psychology. His specialty is a 30-plus year career pioneering work in the area of quality of life, which is focused on aging and elders. And folks, this is going to be an interesting broadcast. In the interest of full disclosure, I had spoken with Bill on a couple occasions before this, and got just a general idea of what the mission of the 2B Foundation is. But I have questions, as you will have questions when you listen to, as you listen to this broadcast. We are waiting for him to call in, and I have a number already up on the board, but it doesn't look like his number, so I'm waiting for him to call. Let me see if this is his number. If not, I'm going to ask that person just to hold on. Here he is. All right, he just came on. Right. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Your first name, please, and where you're calling from? Hello? Oh, no one there. Very good. Hello, Bill?
Yes.
Bill, okay, very good. Actually, we had a caller even before you called. But I think the person hung up when they realized that you were not on the air yet. And it was area code, I think, 540. I don't know who it is. So when I clicked on to tell them that they were preempting our guest, the person hung up. So it looks like we had a big head start on that. Well, good evening, Bill, and thank you so much for being our guest. It's a pleasure. I did read the observations of my colleague, you know, by Dr. John Cull, and I was going to read, but I'm going to leave this to you now. The on the membership drive contest page of the 2B Foundation, I think outlines the foundation, but instead of hearing it from me, I am sure everyone would love to hear it from you, and you better start from scratch because we are all I guess we're dying with anticipation as to what all this is about.
Well, let me first off give a brief discussion about my colleague, John Call, since he was kind enough to write some words about me a few years ago, just before he died. And John was, besides being my major professor in graduate school, was also connected with my career in a very pivotal way. We became close friends and colleagues, and the work that he did was to be involved with the rehabilitation counseling program in the United States. And actually, he was one of the pioneers, and with John, I got an opportunity to work with him in delivering that kind of curriculum in the university system throughout 38 countries. And a lot of our work, basically, we discovered was really about an area that we're going to talk about today, which is quality of life.
Okay.
And quality of life is really not a degree program. You don't find it in any particular university today, but it was something that we decided was an issue, and particularly a major issue in the 20th century because of so many social, political, economic, and other changes that have occurred to create what I would call a remarkable change in the personality, the character, and behavioral patterns of humans as we age. And so in our work, as the interest in quality of life developed, we were looking pretty much at the continuum of aging. And at a point in time, we decided there had to be a solution pathway as well. And we knew we couldn't take care of everybody, from children to elders. So we had to make a decision, and that decision was based on specific rationales, which we'll talk about a little later. But we decided we were going to concentrate or focus on what is arguably the greatest crisis of the 21st century, and that is the plight of elders globally, not just in the United States, but throughout the entire world. I mean, this is an extraordinary time to have to be alive, considering that in the thousands of years, actually since the dawn of man, humans have always aged in circumstances that were very different than they are today. And by that, I mean that one of the key elements that humans look to in terms of emotional support, financial support, social networking, was the family.
Right.
And the family is probably arguably the most critical unit in the history of mankind. It's been the starting point for us. It's been the training point for us. And as we age, normally there was an air of respect that attended to an individual by virtue of age and experience, but that individual was able to pass on the benefit of experience. And so aging people have aged differently throughout most of history than they have for the last 100 years.
All right, I agree. Yeah, correct. Bill, let me Bill.
Yes.
We do have a caller on the line, and caller, you're from 540 area code. If you would just hold on, since we've just started, I hate to have you hold on, but we haven't started the program yet. You're more than welcome to hold on, and we'll get to you just a little bit later on. Okay, Bill, thank you very much.
I think one of the things that's most important when we're thinking about how we aged up until, say, the year 1900, is that there was a notion that scientists and psychologists talk about in terms of gender roles. And there was always a comfort level throughout history of what a gender role means, because there are biological proclivities that basically determine a lot of behavior. Certainly, I think anybody who would argue that men and women are not different, or at least any argument of that sort before 1900, you would have been looked at very strangely. That circumstance has changed dramatically in the 20th century. But up until, say, the end of the 19th century, men and women behaved differently, accepted their roles, and there was an expectation that the male would be involved in livelihood expectations, which means producing whatever it took in terms of food, money, clothing, things of that nature, to be able to support that side of the family. And there was a very critical role that was acceptable and was dignified for women up until, say, 1900, which was child-rearing, which probably arguably was a much more challenging task than any task any man ever had to undertake.
Right.
But nonetheless, that was the pretty much the background of, in a nutshell, of what's happened throughout history in the first, up until, say, 1900. Late 1900s, the reason I talk about that time frame is because there was a great change when the Industrial Revolution developed, and it had implications that were political and economic, and specifically there were philosophies that were espoused that suggested a change in behavior. And it also, it was suggested largely because people were feeling a sense of somehow being deprived and abused at the same time. And in the culture of the Industrial Revolution, suddenly you had children involved in the workforce for the first time at a young age in an industrial setting. And you also had all members of the family, basically, that were involved in some form of activity that involved, particularly on the East Coast of this country and in Europe, were involved in, could have been involved in economic activity that had to do with livelihood pursuits. And at the same time, they started to compete against men in that kind of an environment. So as political philosophies started to evolve, one of those philosophies is we call socialism, which is one of the founders of the social movement, of course, was Karl Marx and Engels. These two individuals had an idea that somehow there had to be a sense of equality in terms of outcomes, and not just equality of on any other level, but specifically in terms of outcome. And so, as a consequence, this notion began to affect social thinking and economic thinking, even though it didn't take a strong hold in the 19th century. It germinated, and it created what I call, would say, partially calls the seeds of discontent, which we'll see how that played out in the 20th century, and particularly in the early part of the 20th century, when we had the rise of people who, for the first time in history, questioned their gender roles. And so this all has a lot to do, you may not think this has much to do with the process of aging, but it really does. It has a great deal to do with the changes psychologically of a society as a whole, and how that society evolved over the next 100 years from the early part of the 20th century to right about this point in time is there were some remarkable changes that have never in the history of mankind have we ever seen anything that changed the psychology of humans as much as that period of history. And I think...
Hello, Bill? Bill, are
yes,
you there? Oh, okay. Oh, okay. I thought somehow we got cut off, but yeah. Bill, just let me take this opportunity for station identification since somehow I interrupted you. Folks, you're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Right. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are so pleased to have as our guest Mr. William Lenhardt, Dr. William Lenhardt, I'm sorry. He's a founder of the 2B Foundation, and we're talking about elder life care. You know, preparing ourselves for the future, and what Bill is talking about now is how we arrived at the social structure we have today, which basically ignores some of this structure that's been around for thousands of years. Please call in with your questions, but why don't you just wait a little while, 646-652-4620, until we get some groundwork done, and then please call in with your questions, 646-652-4620, and of course your comments are welcomed anytime, comments@libertytalkradio.com. Okay, Bill, thank you.
All right, I will continue.
Right.
Well, and before we move on, let's just stop and think for a minute about what I'm talking about. When I mention the word gender role, it often conjures up a lot of negative emotions, particularly in people today, since we've been through so much enormous propaganda over the last 100 years, that it often conjures up negative emotions, even
That's
anger.
Correct, right.
I think people need to stop and think for a moment that we are, first of all, biological entities. And right. In that sense, there's something that we share with all life, and it doesn't matter whether we're a tree, a wolf, a dog, a cat, a cow. There's one thing that's we hold in common with virtually all other species, and that is, what would it be like if suddenly all of our dogs had a gender crisis?
Yeah, right.
I think if you stop to think about that, we would have female dogs refusing to cooperate in the rearing of puppies.
Right.
And so we wouldn't have very many dogs, would we?
Right.
We'd also, and you have to understand that dogs also, basically, all animals, have role models. And role modeling is extraordinarily important in terms of how society evolves, regardless of species.
Right.
So I can't talk about role models and gender issues on this program at great length. That's another subject that we'd have to cover in another program, but in a nutshell, pretty much that is, I think, something you need to think about. And from that point, we walk into the oven, which is the 20th century. And
right.
What you find at the beginning of the 20th century are bankers, financial people that are very interested in the same things you and I are thinking about, and that's self-preservation, preserving their livelihood and their opportunity. And you have people such as J.P. Morgan, at that time in history, Rockefeller, a number of major, major players on the in the financial world. And they had a special interest, and that interest was control. And so even though they weren't great fans of the Marx philosophy, they were nonetheless still influenced to a certain extent, and I think unknowingly, and we're not really sure that we can connect all the dots specifically to the social movement of the 19th century, but the effect was exactly the same, as the bankers decided that what they wanted to do was somehow control commerce in a way and control commerce in a way that was not in our best
right.
interest. And so what we had at the in the early part of the 19th century was a major change in the way we think about handling money, and the central banking system was hatched.
Right.
Central banking basically is a circumstance, as they envision it, as having a strong central bank that was controlled by the other commercial banks. And at that time, the federal government was also involved in hatching this scheme, and they had an agenda which was contrary to the interest of most people in this country, and for that matter, throughout most of the world. And so the rise of the Federal Reserve basically coincided with the rise of a second institution that evolved rather dramatically, and it was the income tax. Not the first time the U.S. had been taxed. We were taxed, at least the North was taxed during the Civil War under Lincoln.
Right.
But this was a return to, in a very small way, to the beginning of the seeds of what would be changing the behavior of the political forces and the economic forces in the United States, which were going to affect in a very dramatic way the outcomes of aging in the United States. So, moving forward from the income tax, which was about 1913, we have a government that suddenly is a government of the people at that time, where an individual would be elected to an office, and it would be a public servant role as he envisioned it at that time in history. Not a very good role. It certainly wasn't a job that he relished. Most politicians in that period of history had other jobs and would see their term of office over and be glad to get home.
Right.
But one of the issues of the tax system as it evolved and how it affected the behavior of politicians was over through the First World War and Wilson, and then into the 20s, and then into the 30s, what we saw was a significant rise of politicians who were returning to office, which was really pretty unheard of. But what was really causing the change was the fact that, like any human who likes his job, they were finding that there was a way to use tax funds to facilitate the interest of constituents to continuously reelect them. And of course, the more money a politician can give away, the more money he has to guarantee his role in government.
Right.
So, how this has affected the aging process is that during the Roosevelt administration, when there was the imminent war and the Depression, the hunger for capital at the federal level was at a point where the federal government was looking at what kind of humanitarian role it could rationalize to cause elder people to subscribe to the idea of a better life in their elder years, and of course the Social Security system, which was really the second major income tax that was imposed on people. And of course, the difference between the first income tax and the second is that the second one was inescapable. There were no deductions.
Right.
It was a flat tax, basically you had to pay, and of course it evolved in such a way that it was confiscated at the point of payment, and it was also paid by both the employer and the individual. Of course,
right.
As we all know, only the individual really pays in the Social Security system.
Right.
But what really evolved here is as the tax system increased, you had a war which needed to be funded, and the United States basically entered the war with gusto. It absorbed the full concentration of the entire country in such a way that what evolved was something very interesting, is that between the tax rates, between the effort for the war, between the increase in interest of the federal government for sustaining its own power and increasing its power, allegedly for humanitarian good, you start to see people in this society release their personal responsibility. In other words, they started to delegate more. And this is a big step in history, because throughout most of history, people did not delegate. Although humans being what we are, we tend to be lazy. And if we see value in delegating to someone else, whether it be in a job or in any other capacity, we can often be talked into it in the name of efficiency.
Right.
Well, every rationale in the world could not have prevented what began to happen during the 50s and 60s and 70s as we moved towards the 21st century. And that is, we also see a decline in the sense of mutual vulnerability. We no longer have any self-respect or respect for each other. And genders, by the 1960s, were literally at war. There were demonstrations, there was violence, and women had become aware of the fact that somehow they were supposed to be angry. And we have a society at large that did not accept the fact that there were any differences between the sexes. And because you place the two sexes in a competitive force, basically in both expecting to be involved in livelihood expectations, which you remember before the 19th century was always the role of one gender. We now have people whose expectations, women whose expectations have been built in such a way that they could never possibly fulfill those expectations. There's just no way it could ever be done.
Right. You know, but
children are raised.
Right. I'm sorry, Bill, I stepped over your words. I apologize for that. But you used a term that heretofore I never thought of before, I mean in this context, and that is that you said that the men and women were competing against each other. And I've never heard it in that context. But once you say that, it conjures up images that are basically inconsistent with a female-male paradigm, if you will. Maybe that's not the right term. Because we should not be in competition with one another. We should be we're different, and we should be complementing one another. And this is what I'm... And, you know, when you said that, it just hit me with like a ton of bricks, is that I never thought of that as being... that the strife, the feminist movement et al., was ever one of competition, but it is. It's one of competition when heretofore it was men and women were complementing one another. And I think that is absolutely profound and something that our listeners should really think about when you watch the news, whatever you do. It should be a critical thinking point right then and there. But go ahead, Bill. By the way, I have the microphone, just let me break for a 1 minute early station identification so I do not have to interrupt you again. Folks, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are pleased to have Dr. William Linhart, founder of the 2B Foundation, with us this evening. His organization attempts to solve the problems of those facing, you know, the latter years of life without government intervention. And this is a task to be admired for sure. So we are talking, and he's giving us some background now. So I'm going to ask everyone to please hold off on your questions until we get a little bit more foundation, maybe a little later on in the program. Okay, thank you very much. Bill, go ahead.
All right, so you have three very interesting things happening by the 1960s. You have the rise in the gender problem that I talk about, which is an issue which is causing an enormous amount of frustration, because for the first time in history, the expectation of women is to compete in the workforce in livelihood pursuits along with men. Second thing you have going on is the fact that humans, because of the circumstances of a complex society and the rising cost, are more willing now to delegate away responsibility and their sense of self-reliance. So that's going on at the same time. And the third thing that's happening, which is an interesting phenomenon, is that politicians at the same time in history are beginning to realize that they like their jobs. Their income is dramatically increased by the 1950s. Under the Eisenhower administration, and by the 1960s, they now think of themselves as indispensable.
Right.
They want to create a professional job force in politics And that's never happened before, except under kings and monarchs and that sort of a system. But in a system that was based on what had evolved as a democracy, and we can talk about that as well, what we have now is a political class that lacks its jobs. They want to know how to preserve those jobs. And so they have become disenfranchised and disconnected in a very real way from their constituents,
right,
except for one thing, how they can be reelected.
Right.
So those three things, the gender issue, the giving away, delegating away responsibility, and so the people become less self-reliant, and the political forces at the same time taking a stronger interest in their job roles, is the ingredients of the destruction of aging. Because if you recall, at the end of the 1960s, after John Kennedy had died, and we have a new president who decides to fight a war in Vietnam, and then subsequently turns around and wants to decides he wants to fight a second war, and his second war is in is the war on poverty. And it was more than a war on poverty. It was a war to finish the unfinished business of the FDR administration, which had to do with entitlements. This is a new word that most people hadn't really become familiar with.
Right.
It was not used during the 1930s. It wasn't used in the 1940s, but it became a household word by the late 60s and 70s. And today, anybody who says the word entitlements, I'm sure everybody on this phone knows exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
So the entitlement became a mechanism of reinforcement where political people saw that by raising tax burdens on the family, and I don't think this was thought through very carefully, but they, as rising tax burdens occurred in the early 1970s, when I was a young worker in the state of Virginia, I remember very clearly my tax burden seemed to go up almost weekly. And I actually made the statement before I was married. I said, you know, I need to get a wife because I can't afford to pay taxes anymore. I was making, 1970, I was making, in 72, I made $27,000 a year. And I remember a little over half of that went to federal taxes.
Wow.
And I kept thinking to myself, you know, I can't continue to afford this. Now, $27,000 was a fairly good income.
Oh, yeah, 1972 was excellent. Absolutely, yeah.
Right. And I was considered high income at that time.
Right.
And, of course, tax rates, I don't think a lot of people realize they were extraordinarily high.
Yeah.
And actually went down from that point and settled in around 35-36% on the high net worth individuals. So what actually happened with me in deciding I needed to get a wife to pay the taxes so that I could support, so I'd have enough money to eat, the rest of the country went the same direction. Those who had wives put their wives to work. Well, you know, it was really pretty hard to survive. Remember, the 1950s was very prosperous under Eisenhower.
Right.
Kennedy actually
right.
came in office and lowered taxes,
right.
increased prosperity.
Right.
He was then killed. We won't go into that story. But
yeah, okay.
But Kennedy was killed. And Johnson, who was not Kennedy's friend, had an agenda. And his agenda basically was very consistent with Karl Marx in increasing
right.
the burdens of taxation in order to do what? What was the outcome of all this? The outcome was to cause some arbitrary sense of equality
right.
between men and women.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, this is a political and economic sense, but from a gender perspective, it never worked. And so what happened? We now have angry men. We have gender issues with men now, and we have angry women. And for the first time in history, there's nobody home.
That's right.
What are you going to do with the kids?
Right.
What are you going to do with mom and dad?
Right.
Who took care of Mom and Dad until 1900. Let's stop and think about it. I'm going to walk back in time a little bit for a second here. Let's everybody try to imagine what your grandparents, your great-grandparents did. Where did they live? And I realize one of the changes in the world during the Industrial Revolution and the move westward from Europe was that people traveled and they dispersed. So families were broken up to a certain extent anyway.
Right.
But never to the extent that we did it in the 1970s. I mean, it was never done with force. It was done by volunteerism. And so most likely, if you think about your great-grandparents, they probably lived in a neighborhood. Probably lived in the same house and died in the same neighborhood in the same house
they
lived
correct.
In all their
right.
years, and they probably had family close by. They probably were involved with their grandkids. They probably took care of them. Mom and Dad were back and forth to the same household, or maybe two generations lived in the same household, but the fact
right.
remains
that's right.
there was a sense of comfort that emanated from the fact that there was no financial stress. There was a sense of that the livelihood expectations of being cared for in your elder years were going to be there, because after all, you raised your kids. There was a sense that your kids now owed you an obligation.
That's right.
Now stop and think about it. Stop and think about how that has changed in 40 years.
Right.
The day we actually have people on the street will say, I do not want to be a burden to my children.
That's right.
Has everybody on this phone heard that?
I'm sure everyone has.
I mean, and we actually have embraced that idea, and we've accepted it.
Right.
Never in history would a person and a functional family, particularly an aging individual, turn to their family and said, look, guys, I'm moving out of the house. I'm not going to live here anymore. I'm taking your mom with me. We're going to go somewhere, so we're not going to be a burden to the family. We'll figure out how to eat. We'll figure out how to take care of ourselves. Somehow we'll manage. But it's more important you all go on and take care of yourself.
Yeah, and what's interesting, Bill, is that we never hear anyone challenge that. Whenever we hear comments like that, I don't want to be a burden to my children, no one challenges it. Everyone admires it. They say, oh, I admire you for taking that position. If I can just make one comment, this is probably loosely associated to what we are talking about. I recall something like decades ago, a question was asked on NPR radio. What one event changed the family more than any one event in history? And of course, you know, people called in Social Security, blah, blah, blah. And guess what the answer, I'm not going to ask you to guess what the answer is. That's silly, you know. Of course, I didn't know what it was. I thought it was the things that we are talking about. And the guy said, the person who was speaking at the time, I don't recall who it was, said, the TV dinner. Mom was no longer necessary. We can go to the store and buy a meal. And he said, you have no idea what impact sociologically that had on our, you know, on the family. And no one ever thought of that. I never thought of that. Can you imagine the TV dinner was the most significant effect, having a negative effect on the family. Amazing. But
well,
I just bring that up, you know.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but the issue that the television has, and you're very right, is the fact that basically all living organisms are subject to imitation. We learn by imitation. We learn by role modeling. And what the television offered basically was a surrogate, and a phenomenal surrogate in the sense that it gave us opportunity to watch other people's lives and in a vicarious way to live out those experiences in a way that was very negative.
Yeah.
Now stop and think about the media. Media basically being, at that time, probably more independent, but at the same time, it was a matter of being able to control the message that was delivered by the popular media, which was television and radio, of course, before that. And so what individuals for the first time in history were subject to, they got comfortable with watching television as a form of entertainment,
right.
and they actually started to look forward to it, in a way that began to have a very powerful effect on the way we aged from, say, the late 1940s, I'd say around 1950, when really televisions became on the scene in large numbers, until today. And of course, many shows were produced by a constituency of individuals who had agendas basically to support the popular notions of socialism and the popular notions of philosophies that really flew in the face of quality of life in every way.
Right.
And everything we're talking about right now has to do with one issue, quality of life. Can't get off of that subject.
Right.
The implications are very, very real. But I want to get back for a minute, if I can, to talk a little bit just about what happened in the early 1970s, which I think was really interesting.
Yeah, may I make one comment, Bill?
I'm
sorry, Bill. May I make one comment? When you had mentioned people, a very common statement is, "I don't want to be a burden to my children." But at the same time, many of those people make certain that they are preserving enough cash so when they die, they can leave it to their children.
Well, not today they won't.
No, not today. Today they're having a problem. But it's amazing how you hear both of those sometimes in tandem with one another. I don't want to be a burden, and when I go, I have everything, my will set up, so my children get all this, this and that. And they're worried about their children, and yet it just seems to be backwards. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, it's an inconsistency, right. But it is explainable. And you can see the rationales, but it's explainable in the same way that when people become discount their gender roles, that's an inconsistency as well.
Right.
And a lot of this has to do with propaganda that was forced upon people for the purpose of driving agendas, political agendas, economic agendas, whatever that happens to be. And so when we talk about the fact that we don't want to be burdens to our kids, we're never in history where we have ever even considered such a notion. That was all preparation for something that was coming, which was basically some way to equalize society. So when you're not a burden to your kids, somehow their lives are independent, they can move on, and you are somehow enabling that situation by leaving that household.
Right.
And so there was a great push in the 1970s to figure out, well, now that there's no money anymore. Now, remember, the 70s were not good economic times.
Right.
I don't think most people realize that
That's right.
1980, under the Carter administration, interest rates were up to almost...
Were they 21% or something?
21 points.
Yeah, something like that. 21% or something like that, yeah.
So the decision now of mom and dad, who were burdened by a new tax circumstance to have to fight the war in Vietnam, which was still roaring in 1970 under Nixon, and the war on poverty, which basically became an extraordinary war, was that something had to give. And what we did as a society is we institutionalized two things. We created an institution for our elders called long-term care. And just as damaging, we delegated away the care of our kids to daycare.
That's right.
Two institutions developed almost simultaneously. Most incredible thing ever in history. And I was there at the time. I was an observer close at hand. And it happened really quite dramatically and quite quickly. And people just didn't see it. And it was looked at as a positive at the time. This is great. We're going to put mom and dad in a nursing home.
That's
right. We're
going
to put mom and dad into assisted living.
That's right.
We don't have to take care of them anymore.
That's right.
Guess what? Government's going to pay for it. They've increased all these taxes. Now Social Security's going up along with Medicare. We've now got Medicare to pay for it, too. It's 15% of their income. But man, I'm paying it, and it's going to take care of everything. This was the mindset of people in the 70s, the early 70s.
Right.
We had no idea what we had just done.
Well, you know, a new concept is never adorned with the unintended consequences. That comes about 20 years or whatever down the road where we look back and we go, oh, my goodness, what did we create? But go ahead, Bill. But I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, that's exactly right. What we have done, we became the delegation society, and this is what I was talking about a minute ago. Under Roosevelt, the whole thing started to evolve very gradually. When we had so little time Mom stayed at home in the United States. Dad went to the war. She had to take care of the kids and work in the factory at the same time to support the family. It was a very hard life, but it was a dedicated life because of the worship of the government.
Right. You know, Bill, my mom was the old fashioned one. She was such a sweetheart. Everyone loved her. You could always find my mother. You always knew where she was, in the kitchen. and if you stopped over to say, you just walked in the house, uninvited, she said, oh, sit down. She says, oh, don't worry, sit down. Don't get nervous. She says, I'll make you something. We'll eat, you know. I mean, she was the most adorable person in the world. I mean, they don't make them like that anymore. And, you know, so strangely enough, she never even drove a car. I mean, she didn't have to. You know, we lived in East Harlem, New York. You know, she had her kitchen. My father went to work. You know, this is the way everything worked. And it worked beautifully. You know, of course, I was a horrible son, you know. but I digress. And it was very interesting that it was so different. But yet, and I have a caller, a listener from Chile. And he sent me, and I'm sorry for the interruption, but I think this ties in, if you don't mind me saying, telling the story. And he wrote, he writes to me from time to time, sends me pictures of radio. And I wrote back to him one time. I said, his name is Tom. I said, in southern Chile, by the way. And I said, Tom, I said, nice pictures. I said, appreciate it. Everyone looks so poor. He said, yes. And by the way, he's done pretty well. He's an American who's moved out to Chile. He's done pretty well for himself. He said, yeah. He says, I literally live in a shack, he said, if you will. Americans would call this a shack. And he says, but every night, everybody gets together. He says, the families are intact here. No one has money, but they all have each other. And he says, I prefer it this way. And this is recent. This is only the past couple of months that this guy wrote to me like that. And he made a good point. And you think back, you say, these people have what we would consider nothing, but they have everything. But go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry.
Yes, again, it's not a question of how much people had in society in the 19th century. It was a question of the cohesion and the sense of harmony speaks to the very soul of quality of life, and that's what we've lost.
Right.
And in the interest of time, because I see the time creeping on, I know some people probably want to get on this show, but what I just wanted to say is the 2B Foundation, which was the work of my colleague and me, that we essentially started, we saw that there had to be a solution pathway. That we had to be able to interface with the government and the economic environment, the psychological environment of the world, in a way that we were able to look at the problem and maybe develop a real understanding of what the problem was and be able to come up with a solution. So we worked a great deal of our time on a solution, and we've come up with a solution. We're not going to talk about the solution tonight. I'd rather leave that for another discussion later. But the 2B Foundation, which was our life's work, has, in fact, developed a way out of this. And what we're looking to do basically is energize constituents across the country, develop the energy to a point where we have the power to deliver a message and to start the course of meaningful change. So it's extremely important that we get to that point as quickly as possible.
Right.
So we are looking to develop our membership. We're looking to develop donations, like all foundations, and we're looking to develop the power of carrying the message. And anybody who's on this phone probably would be interested, if they're interested in learning more about the 2B Foundation, they can go to www.2B, number 2, the letter B, foundation.org. And with that, Joe, I'll let you take any callers that may be waiting.
Right. Well, callers, I know you've been coming on and off and listening, and I know we have a bunch of listeners, and you know not everyone calls in who listens, but if you are still listening and you did want to call, this is an excellent time to do so. We have about 8 minutes, so if you want to call in now. If you don't, I know who you are. I'm going to come out and get you. You know what I mean? Okay. Bill, this is an international effort. It seems to me to be Herculean in effort. I don't even know where to start because you're right. It was a process that took almost a century, you know, to go from the old way to where we are now. What do you expect? I mean, how do you turn this battleship around with a broken rudder? I mean,
the first thing you have to understand is the problem, and you have to be able to identify. Once you understand the problem, then you have the tools to understand how to change that problem. And we can't go back to the 19th century overnight. That would be impossible.
Right.
But there are certain things that we can do, that we have the power to do, and that we're going to begin to put into effect. And as a matter of fact, we're putting into effect right now as we speak. And the real problem, in a nutshell, that has affected elders throughout the world, not just here, but in all the developed countries of the world, which have adopted a similar entitlement system where they've changed the gender roles of both men and women, is to drive the level of financial frustration to a point that we now see elder people, for the first time in history, suffering from increased levels of depression, anxiety, and stress.
Right.
That has never before happened in history. And what is the main cause of that, besides the loss of the family, is
right,
the loss of financial integrity.
Right. We have a caller, Bill. Let's
create
yes. this call. Call your area code 903. Your first name, where you're calling from, and your question and comments, please. And thank you for calling Liberty Talk Radio.
Hi, my name is Sherry. I'm from Texas. I just really wanted to find out if there was a way that you could tell me how it's really going to change the way that elders really live 10 years from now. How is it really going to impact them socially and economically?
Okay. Well, actually, you're getting into the subject of what I would think would be the next show, because that's a whole discussion in itself, that's the solution. But what I do see is that we can affect a change in this way. We can demonstrate a change based on what we now know, and the solution that we have can be implemented in targeted locations around the world. So that what we can do at the end of the day is be able to show in a very real way the restoration of quality of life, in that quality of life will definitely improve if we can terminate or lessen stress, anxiety, and depression. And to do that, we have to be able to address the problem from an economic perspective. Because the problem, we're talking about, is economic. And economic in the sense that elders have lost their financial integrity. If we can restore their financial integrity and show they can have it restored, we then have a real platform to discuss on the level of governments throughout the world a way to once and for all reduce dependency on entitlements, and once and for all be able to increase the quality of life of virtually everybody in society. So, I mean, we really have a great answer for that, but I'd rather not get into the details tonight.
Coley, do you have any comments or questions?
No, that was all. I just really wanted to kind of see how the impact of what TV Foundation would be doing for the community, for the state, for the livelihood of the nation. Sounds great. It sounds very promising, and I'm excited about what is in the future and what is to come.
I'm inviting Bill to come back next Sunday. I hope he accepts my invitation. And at that time, we will go through solutions. And if you'll listen in and even call in again, that'll be great. Thank you very much. Okay, now we have another call. This one's from 918 area code. Caller,
yep.
You're on the air. Your first name, where you're calling from, please. Thank you for calling Liberty Talk Radio.
This is Jim from Bixby.
Hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest exactly where this foundation is, evolution and growth. Are you still in the planning and promotional, creating awareness to it? Are you you have some projects that are underway and success stories? Is it a matter of fundraising? Where are you at, and what are the greatest hurdles that you're trying to work through?
The foundation actually began with a company that we founded in the 1990s. My colleague Don Call and I, left the workplace as basically went on our own and developed a schedule to work full time on the understanding the problem, which meant research, and at the same time developing the solution. So we've worked probably 15 years, and we founded the foundation officially in the year 2002.
Okay.
And since the time the foundation was established, it was established as a Nevada chartered corporation, and it's a 501c3. The intent was to be able to establish eventually, when we had the answers, to go out and seek a constituency that would embrace our ideas and have the energy to become engaged as self-reliant individuals and families again, to meet by phone, to create opportunities through the internet, to be able to interface and to organize this vast intent throughout the world in a way that we would have the power to be able to take back our quality of life. We have the answers. We're not going into the details tonight, but we do have the answers. Some of those, the indications of some of those answers are on our website, as I pointed out. And really what we have is a cause. And I think everybody, regardless of who you are or where you are, is interested in your quality of life. And if you don't take charge of this right now, we're in big trouble, because we've got a $100 trillion-plus unfunded liability to the next generation of retirees. There's no way to pay that.
Yeah, Bill, I have to interrupt. We're running out of time, and we're gonna be shut off really soon. I'm awfully sorry. Jim, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it very much. But we're going to ask Bill to come back next Sunday. I hope you do join us at that time.
Great. Thank you for your answer, Doctor.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Okay, we got about 15 seconds. Will you accept my invitation to come back next Sunday, 7 o'clock?
Yes, I'd love to. And again, please, everybody, join our foundation on our website. You can join on the site itself, www.2bfoundation.org. We'd be delighted to talk to you in person. Give us a call or email us.
Okay,
Bill. I look forward to hearing from me. I'll be back next week.
All right, Bill, thank you so much. It's been enlightening, and I look forward to the next program. Good night.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Now, I learned a lot, and we could have gone on for hours. This is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends, and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away, or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there's no middle ground. Ron Paul has a sign at his desk that says, "Don't steal. The government hates competition." Until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.